mind prompted. Things Horst had said about trips on high-altitude zeppelins coalesced with hints about the professor.
The May raid? Is that what they want him for?
10 German airships had raided Paris on May 5th, coming in at night and very high to avoid the fighting scouts guided by searchlights. They dropped gas, not explosives. 100-pound sheet metal containers full of phosgene mixed with chlorine as a spreading agent, and a small bursting charge set to explode at 300 meters up. The carnage had been terrible, since on a short trip from the German bases in Belgium, each airship had been able to carry tons of the noxious stuff. Thousands dead, and many more blinded or crippled. Mass panic and flight.
But if Horst and the Herr Doctor were both involved in that, and they were both in America just now, this has to be some sort of project aimed at us, but maybe related to that raid. Perhaps it was a trial run? Berlin knows we're coming into the war soon. They don't have any more incentive to avoid angering us. But a transatlantic raid would be very difficult with any worthwhile payload. Oh, this really is big. It's worth anything to get the intelligence on it back to Washington.
The thought flickered through her mind in an instant, and a cold prickle ran over her skin. Aloud, she went on.
"We have to intercept them before they leave this floor with him," she said. "But Horst, we'll have to take them by surprise, unless you want a gunfight right here. They could have anything up to machine carbines in those bags, depending on how badly they want this man."
He winced and bared his teeth.
"They will want him very badly," he admitted, "assuming that they know who he really is, which is a good bet at this point. And from Amsterdam, they could consult with Paris on secure lines easily to get orders."
"If we try to play it safe and stop them flat before they reach him, we're actually increasing our risk and his, especially since you want to keep this quiet. We're outnumbered, so we need tactical surprise, and it's worth it if they're not going to kill him. And to kill him, they wouldn't need 4 men. One man with a knife or a muffled pistol would do fine."
Unwillingly, he nodded. That meant letting the French agents get into the professor's room, letting them think they had him secured and nothing to worry about except an inconspicuous extraction, and then hitting them from the rear. The slight extra risk that they'd simply kill him was worth it.
"How long to open one of these doors?"
Horst said musingly, as if speaking to himself. She answered straightforwardly.
"Seconds if they have a passkey, and I think they probably do."
"In this whore of a merchant city?" "Yeah."
"I could get through one of these locks in about 20 seconds with my picks," she said, tapping her finger lightly on the box lock. "Less after I practice on this one a bit. And if they don't leave their key in the other side of the lock. If they do, we'd have to break in. Or they may not lock it behind them at all, if they're set on speed. They could leave one man on guard in the corridor. That's likely, from the way they handled getting set up in their own room. In, snatch the professor, get him back to their room, and lock his door behind them." "And if he's behind the Paris attack, they'll want him very, very badly, for which I don't blame them in the least. Odd I'm going to have to kill them for the greater good, defending thoroughly wicked enemies. But there you are. That's espionage for you."
Aloud, she went on.
"I'd have a much better chance of taking out a guard quietly if they do, so I'd better go out first."
He closed his eyes and thought again.
"Yeah. We will have to do it that way. I do not like it, but yes." A chuckle. "I am going into battle beside a woman. Not something I had imagined. And yet I find your presence profoundly comforting, Elisa."
"Not many I'd rather have on my side in a fight either, Horst," she said.
Technically, he was going into battle behind a woman, but it wouldn't be tactful to mention that. His eyes went to a clock on the mantel above the hearth.
10 o'clock. They will not move for some time. At least 4 hours. Good. You will have time for dinner to settle.
She nodded. The best time for that sort of operation in a large city was a few hours after midnight, which was as close to deep sleep as a metropolis got.
You should get some more rest if you can, she said. I'll wake you in 2 hours, or if they move.
He went out and returned with a comforter and pillow for himself and another for her to kneel on. One of the things she respected in him was that he didn't need to chatter. She settled in to wait, letting her mind drift without words and keeping her eyes a little out of focus as she looked through the keyhole. All she had to watch for was movement.
"Hist,"
Horst said softly, then plugged the keyhole with his thumb for an instant.
"They're moving."
Luce came out of her half-doze instantly. Some inner sense told her it wasn't long before dawn, and the air had a peculiar stale stillness. The clock said 3:45. She rolled to her feet and waited, still loose from her last set of stretches. They looked at each other as the half-minute mark went by. Horst showing his teeth in an unconscious snarl, and Luce smiling slightly and letting the koche slip into her right palm with its loop around her wrist while she undid the collar of her pajama jacket. He nodded and opened the door, standing behind it as she went out first, though she could see his repugnance at it in every inch of his taut body. There was no way any French agent was going to look at him and see anything but a very dangerous German, though. And, gracias a Dios, Horst was smart enough to see that.
"Whereas I'm a good-looking young woman in the sort of pajamas a cinema siren would wear, or a very high-class courtesan, I suppose."
The doors on this floor were fairly far apart, since most of them led to multi-room suites. There was a Frenchman standing mock-casually outside the Herr Dr. Professor's. He came alert as the door opened, and she thought she recognized the knee-forward stance of a saboteur. Then he saw who she was and relaxed, taking his hand out from beneath his jacket. Luce smiled slightly, putting on a sleepy, sated, pouting look, and rolling her hips a little more, and saw his eyes drop to the hint of cleavage, showing where the top two buttons of her jacket were undone.
"Oh, you deserve this so much, Francois," she thought.
"Que vrai. Darwin never sleeps."
Still smiling, she pivoted smoothly on her right heel and drove the ball of her left foot up between his legs as hard as she could. That would have hurt even if he were wearing a cup, and he wasn't. The thump of impact was followed less than a second later by another as she brought the cosh around and down on the back of his head, which was presented to her neatly as he bent over, gasping, with his mouth wide open, and no sound but a breathy hiss coming out of it. The fine lead shot inside the leather transmitted all the force of the full-armed strike with her weight behind it as it flattened against the bone, and he fell as limp as a puppet with its strings cut. He might well be dead. She hadn't pulled the blow. It would have been insane to do so. The first time Luce had killed had been on the night her parents died. It had been one of the revolucionarios. She'd cut his throat when he staggered drunkenly by her hiding place to piss out some of the looted pulque. And she'd taken his rifle and bandolier and clothes and horse to escape into the silent Sonoran desert. Pedro's lessons had worked perfectly. Hand over the mouth and nose, jerk back in the same motion, drag the cutting edge down diagonally from below the ear to past the Adam's apple. She'd had nightmares about it for a long time. The sudden smell, like wet iron, added to the rebel's stale sweat and tobacco and liquor, and the hot flood over her hand, black in the darkness, lit only by the last flames of the hacienda's Casa Grande, and the body twitching beneath her until it went flaccid. After that, it got easier and easier. Sometimes she was a little troubled that it didn't trouble her much anymore. Horst was beside her before the Frenchman had finished slumping into a puddle, moving like a big golden cat. He looked down at the body and pursed his lips admiringly, then put his big left hand on the doorknob. In his right was what they call the trench knife these days, a cut-down bayonet with a set of brass knuckles added to the hilt and a lead knob on the pommel. It looked crude and ugly and effective, which was truth in advertising, and he had a Luger tucked into his belt. Luce drew in a long breath, let it out, felt her pulse slow a little, and nodded. He turned the knob. The door wasn't locked, then crouched and lunged through as it opened, going instantly from a standing start to a blur of speed like a charging tiger. The suite was a mirror image of the one next door that Horst had booked, and this was the large sitting room. There were the remains of a meal on the table and four men. Two of the Frenchmen were holding the professor. He sagged between them in his old-fashioned nightshirt, blood streaming from a cut under his thick white hair, and his eyes rolled up as one of them pressed a damp cloth over his mouth and nose. The third had a Star Model 14 automatic in his gloved hand, with blood on the barrel. So he'd pistol-whipped the elderly German to quiet him for the chloroform. Probably a mixture of alcohol and chloroform and ether, since the pure stuff didn't work as well as fiction would have it. He leveled the weapon as the other two dropped the half-conscious academic unceremoniously. Luce whirled the kosh around her head once by the strap, and then threw it across the 10 feet separating them. The man whipped up his right hand to protect his face, fired, and missed. Horst closed with him. The first of the two Frenchmen who'd been holding the old German came at her with a pivot like a dancer, his left foot flicking up and snapping around for her head. A fouette figure, a high whip kick. It was delivered with bone-cracking force and dangerously fast. She barely managed to go in beneath it, weight and momentum pushing her down as she let her knees go slack, and threw out her left hand to stop the fall. The Navaja snicked open in her right, and she cut viciously at his groin as she rose. He tumbled backward just in time to avoid having the inside of his thigh sliced open, and came upright with a knife in his own hand. It was a narrow, double-edged blade, and he held it point down with his other hand covering it, Apache style. Some distant part of her noticed that the Duchesne Bureau were apparently recruiting street fighters from the gangs who haunted the drinking kens of Ménilmontant, or at least using them as trainers.
"Come to me and die, puto gabacho,"
she snarled in Spanish. His dark eyes flared as he recognized the blade in her hand and the way she held it, and this time there was no nonsense about her sex. He probably wasn't seeing anything but knife, hands, and feet. Then his covering hand moved in an extravagant gesture designed to distract the eye, while the point of the knife lanced forward, Apache style again. They were already too close to strike without footwork.
"When you are ojo a ojo, someone is going to die very soon,"
old Pedro's voice echoed in her mind.
"You are committed. Strike or die. There is nothing else."
Her blade moved in a smooth, swift florotazzo toward his midsection, point lowered and edge turned to the left. The Frenchman's guarding hand flashed out to grab her wrist and immobilize it while he struck himself. The hand slapped down on her wrist, but the blade wasn't there. He had just time enough to realize she'd flicked it into her rising left inside his guard before the point took him beneath the chin. There was a crisp, popping feel as the 6-inch blade slammed up through his palate and into his brain. And she wrenched the knife free with desperate speed and skipped backward. The third Frenchman might have been a bad problem, except that Horst had just gripped his chin and neck and turned his head until he was staring out from between his shoulder blades. The German dropped the body and put a hand to his side.
"The pig dog kicked me," he wheezed. "I don't think any ribs are broken, though. Or if they are, just a little cracked."
Luz shuddered and took a deep breath as her awareness flared out again into the harsh, blood- and feces-scented aftermath of 20 seconds of combat. There was no time for reaction, or anything but dealing with the consequences. Probably nobody had heard the single shot, or dismissed it. The first man Horst had gone for, the pistolier, was lying on his back with a trench knife jammed up under his breastbone, and apparently stuck fast.
"Close in. Knife beats pistol 9 times in 10, she thought.
Horst was already returning with a handful of towels from the bathroom, and they wrapped them around various wounds. Luckily, the blood stopped pumping out like a hose when the heart ceased beating. But there had already been too much from the loser in the knife duel, and she discovered that there was a tiny nick over her collarbone, where his thrust had almost gone home into her jugular.
"Merde," she thought, sticking a little piece of clean paper over it. "No time."
She stepped to the outer door, checked both ways, and dragged the man she'd coshed over to the French agent's room and threw into their bathroom by his feet. It was convenient that this was a first-class hotel, with a luxury of private bathing facilities for most of the higher-priced rooms. She heaved him into it and helped Horst with the others. The four of them made a mound, even arranged spoon fashion. But with a little effort, they fitted well enough into the big claw-footed cast-iron tub that body fluids and blood would leak down the drain and not drip through the floorboards. It was astonishing how much blood a human being held. And as anyone who'd spilled a bottle could testify, a little went a long way when it got out. The same bathroom furnished towels to replace the ones they'd taken from the professor's suite. Back there, Horst took the half-empty bottle of red wine from the old man's late meal and carefully poured it over the stains on the rug. With luck, that would cover the blood and the smell long enough. They only needed enough time to cross the border, and their train left about dawn. While he did that, she examined the Herr Doktor, reflecting that she'd need a name for him. The wound on his scalp was superficial, though it had bled copiously, as injuries there always did, and she fixed it with sticking plaster and iodine from Horst's supplies. The bone beneath seemed unaffected, but though he seemed in reasonable shape, the skinny old man was at least in his 60s, and he'd been drugged, too, with the usual mixture. At least they'd smeared Vaseline on his face to avoid chemical burns. He stirred as Horst lifted him effortlessly like a child. Another thing that lurid fiction didn't mention was that it took a solid 3 or 4 minutes of breathing through a pad to really put you out. A hypodermic was much better if you were in a hurry. His eyes fluttered open, and he muttered,
"Loki. Hark this Loki. Americans."
That meant Breath of Loki. Loki, the trickster god of the ancient Germanics, who ended up chained to a rock beneath the drip of venom from a serpent. Her parents had read her those stories, with many others, though her father had preferred the Ulster cycle, and her mother the Song of the Cid. Luce carefully didn't react, and the sound died away to mumbles.
"They used a knockout mixture," she said.
She'd sniffed at the cloth before dropping it on the bodies.
"Risky, but I think he'll wake up fairly soon."
"Good,"
Horst said. They tucked the old man into the bed in their suite, making sure he wasn't drooling too much or in danger of choking on his tongue.
"It's only a few hours until we leave for the train. Lucky is that it's right across the square."
Luce nodded thoughtfully.
"Horst, can you square the customs agents on the German side?"
He nodded. "Yes, if I must. We'll be switching to a special train there, direct to..." "Where are we going? Why?"
"Because if the French are this determined, I'd like some more firepower if they try again. And the gabachos were all carrying carpet bags."
His eyes lit.
"Ah, just-in-case gear."
They slipped across again to the room the French had so briefly occupied. It might be her imagination, but she thought she could smell death under the sweet, flowery odor of the bath oil they'd spilled over the bodies. The four identical carpet bags were all resting on the parlor table.
"Ah, was haben wir denn hier?"
Horst said as he opened one, and his brows went up, which was roughly equivalent to, "What have we here?" or, "Well, well, well," a phrase suitable for opening Christmas presents. What they had here was an arsenal. Two sawed-off shotguns, ammunition for them in the form of heavy buckshot and slugs, a half-dozen hand grenades shaped like miniature pineapples.
"English. Mills bombs. Not as good as our Stielhandgranate, but a sound design," Horst remarked.
"The gringos use a similar one lately. But what's this rifle?"
Horst laid out the disassembled weapon, clicked it together, and took it apart again after running his hands over the join. Luce was familiar with it from briefing papers, but she let the German explain. In her experience, most men derived considerable pleasure from explaining things, particularly to women, and it wouldn't be in character for Elisa Carmody to be completely familiar with European military exotica. Luce liked a well-designed weapon, as she did any other tool, enjoyed hunting, and was very competent with them for that or a fight. But she'd never derived that semi-sensual pleasure from guns that she'd seen often in others, and of which Horst showed every sign.
"It's a Meunier semi-auto rifle," Horst said. "A specially made one, for taking down and putting in a small case and assembling again rapidly."
"Semi-automatic? Like the gringo Colt Browning? Those have caused us hard problems."
"Very much like, though it's recoil-operated rather than gas. A good weapon, much better than the label, and a much better 7mm rimless cartridge, too, which they stole from Mauser Werk, though the action is a little delicate for the trenches. The French started producing it just before the war, but they never had enough for general issue. They give it to elite units and marksmen and raiding parties, and 10 clips of ammunition, 50 rounds. Can you use a rifle?"
"Yes,"
she said flatly.
"Quite well."
He nodded, taking her at her word.
"Well, let's take our gifts.
Ah, and the coil of rope. Always useful."
They put the brass "Do Not Disturb" signs on their little chains around the knobs of the French agent's door, and the professor's, with a 1 guilder coin bearing Queen Wilhelmina's rather plump face left in the helpfully provided slot in each for emphasis. The signs were recent inventions, and the mark of a first-class hotel in a sophisticated city. But the thriller writers had already begun to note how they aided skullduggery. When everything was packed, they sat on the sofa together in their own suite to wait the remaining hours. Horst decided that they would ask for an invalid's wheeled chair if the professor hadn't fully recovered by then. Luce shivered a little and leaned against the man's shoulder. He gave her a surprised look and put a gentle arm around her.
"I don't like killing men who've never done me harm," she said. "I will if I have to, but I don't like it." Better then than us. But there may be children who can't understand why their fathers aren't coming home.
After a moment, he said with clumsy goodwill, "They were men fighting for their country and people, as I do for mine, and you do for yours. This was honorable war, with equal chances for us and them, blow for blow, and shot for shot."
"Yes,"
she said, and they waited in silence. 5. Maatschappij tot exploitatie van Staatspoffiger. Netherlands State Railways. Eastern Gelderlands Province. Koninkrijk der Nederlanden. Kingdom of the Netherlands. September 6, 1916. B. It was supposed to be 6 hours from Amsterdam-Centraal to Cologne in Germany. Judging by where they were, across the Rhine and past Arnhem, just beginning to head south, it was going to be at least 2 hours more. In fact, they'd be lucky to make the customs house at Emmerich am Rhein by 2 o'clock. Horst grumbled, his tidy Teutonic soul offended by the irregularity. Luce thought he'd probably have gone mad if he had to live in Mexico or Guatemala or any of a number of places her father had built things. But he allowed that it was probably the result of the war and the shortages of good coal in the Netherlands, which had to import every lump from combatants who needed it themselves. The engine up ahead was wheezing and making asthmatic noises now and then. Even at the peaks between stations, they were doing distinctly less than the 50 miles an hour a passenger express should, which meant there was probably duff and shale in every shovelful going into the firebox. The locomotive had looked like a toy to her anyway. European engines always did, compared to the massive brutes that roamed American railways. At least the first-class passenger compartments were joined along the side by an interior corridor, what Europeans, for some mysterious reason, called the American plan, despite it not being all that common in the United States. A lot of trains here still use the other, older type that had nothing but the exits on the side, showing the design's descent from a string of stagecoaches stuck on a flatbed, which meant you could end up dying to pee while the train crawled between stations, and no place to do it but the floor. She'd left for the ladies' toilet an hour out of Amsterdam, at a hint from Horst, and when she came back, the professor, technically he was Privatdozent Ernst von Bülow, was still chilly and aloof, but at least minimally polite, mostly ignoring her. Luce assumed that Horst had explained to the older man how she'd helped save his wrinkled backside from the French, though he'd still been surprised, or seemed to be, when she spoke excellent upper-class German. She assumed from the slight but detectable edge of a rough Brandenburger accent that he was a genuine Prussian, and not one by historical accident than Frederick the Great's ambition, like Horst the Silesian. But then, nearly all Germans had some sort of regional tinge, even when speaking the standard tongue, which had been more or less made up in the Reformation era, and wasn't something anyone sang lullabies in or shouted in play as a child. From the combination of an academic title and the nobleman's thumb, he was probably also the non-inheriting younger scion of a family with a minor entailed estate out among the pine woods, an estate that in America would qualify as a biggish farm. In England, only the eldest son of a noble had a title, and the rest were commoners. But in Germany, all the children were of the Adel caste, and they bred like rabbits.
"His head probably feels like it's going to explode, between being pistol-whipped and drugged,"
she thought with an attempt at charity by the young and healthy.
"It takes longer to spring back at his age."
They were into the eastern part of Gelderland now, and had turned south, closer and closer to the German frontier, and the land passing by outside their windows was no longer pancake flat.
By Dutch standards, it was mountainous and thinly populated, meaning there were occasional wooded ridges or even low hills, one towering as much as 200 feet into the sky. Wooden fences surrounded the fields, reaped and yellow, and some with sheaves of grain still in pyramidal stooks, or bushy with root crops, or green pasture thronged with fat-looking brown cattle, with odd white bands from top to bottom in the middle of their bodies, like broad belts. Scattered farms stood with brick nogging between their half-timbers, under steep red roofs, and now and then a small castle or stately manor house dreamed amid formal gardens. The occasional, inevitable windmill clacked away, probably grinding the newly harvested grain, and the air through the half-open window smelled warm and sleepy green, and somehow had a hint of first frost soon, under the coal smoke. You can imagine a cotillion in one of those manors, and Mozart lilting softly out the French windows, or a mother in a lace cap spooning cheese soup out of a tureen for eager two-headed children in a farmhouse kitchen of scrubbed wood and shining tile.
Hard to imagine it's the edge of a continent tearing at itself like a mad wolf eating out its own guts,
Luce thought. Horst seemed to catch the thought.
There has been war here often enough, he said. This is where my ancestors broke the Roman frontier 1500 years ago, when Charlemagne fought his long campaigns against the heathen Saxons and Frisians. Viking ships came far up these rivers with their dragon heads to burn and plunder and carry off captives. War in the Middle Ages, war in the 80 years' struggle against the Spanish, war against the French of Louis XIV, and against Napoleon in the time of our own grandparents and their parents. Luce smiled rueful agreement.
There is war where there are human beings, she said.
War is the locomotive of history,
von Bülow said, a bit sententiously. Luce was tempted to argue the point simply because she didn't like him, though in fact the statement was pretty much true as far as she could see, and a rather striking phrase. Instead, she looked at the book beside him, Also sprach Zarathustra, and said,
That bit with the old woman talking to Zarathustra is a metaphorical, you know, Herr Privatdozent.
Privatdozent meant an independent scholar with at least a doctorate who wasn't formally appointed to a university post. It was often somewhat more prestigious than a regular academic position.
And often misinterpreted, she added.
Which part? You have read Nietzsche?
He sounded slightly indignant, as if she'd checked the book out of a library and kept it beyond the return date. She smiled sweetly and fluttered her eyelids.
Why, of course. Hasn't anyone who actually reads read the most influential philosopher of our time? I mean the part where the old woman says to Zarathustra, Du gehst zu Frauen? Vergiss die Peitsche nicht.
Literally, that meant, Thou goest to the women? Forget not the whip. If it wasn't his favorite pair of sentences in the book, she'd stick jalapeno peppers up her nose.
Metaphorical in what sense?
Von Bülow said, his eyes lighting up despite himself. Like most of his breed, he simply couldn't resist word chopping, or textual exegesis if you were feeling charitable.
There are many levels of interpretation possible, of course. This I grant.
Well,
Luce said, opening the Hotel Victoria's lunch basket and handing around the sausage and cheese sandwiches, pickles and apples, and bottles of flavored seltzer water.
Notice that the old woman has just given a wise reply to Zarathustra's first statements about women in general, and that she addresses him with a familiar tu, as if he were a child, and the word she, which is to say Nietzsche, uses for women is Frauen, not Weber,
Frauen and Weiber were more or less precisely equivalent to the English distinction between ladies and females, or between ladies and women in general. With malice aforethought, she added,
"Possibly it helps not to have been born a native German speaker, to appreciate exactly what he's trying to do there."
Luce continued as the professor sputtered.
"With Nietzsche, precise word choice always matters crucially. He's a poet as well as a philosopher who speaks in poetry. He says things that can't be summed up in a single declarative sentence, the way you can the price of apples. Hinting at truths whose meaning can only be approached elusively, recursively, because language itself creaks beneath the weight. Each word is surrounded by a penumbra of possible meanings that must be considered together, rather than one being chosen and the others dismissed."
Horst was leaning back, with a straightened expression on his face, as if he were fighting down a delighted grin.
"Yes, there are times when it's a bit of a struggle not to like him too much," she thought.
Luce spread a napkin across her knees. Von Bülow did likewise, and took a bite of his sandwich, and chased it with the fizzy water, frowning. Luce bit into hers. Inside the crusty roll was Ossenwurst, a raw beef sausage made with pepper, cloves, mace, and nutmeg, and then slow-smoked at low temperature.
"That, I have to admit, the Dutch do very well, and this Gouda is excellent."
Von Bülow looked past the wall of the carriage.
"Granting as a general principle of the elusiveness of Nietzsche's prose for the sake of argument, particularly with respect to this work, what is your specific interpretation?"
the academic said challengingly.
"Can there be a new one of so seminal a work?"
"My interpretation would be twofold. First, the old woman is reminding Zarathustra of the whip the woman holds, her role as the maker into human of the wild beast boy-man whom she mothers, and how more generally she uses the whip of restraint, of culture, to tame the male. So Zarathustra should take care when he goes to the ladies, lest they tame him with their whips. Him, in this case, of course, being not merely Zarathustra in this passage, but that screaming child he carries. The child of his mind, surely. His truth, that he fears is too loud."
"Outrageous sophism," Von Bülow said. "Why so contradict the first reading?" "Oh."
"Oh, indeed. And note that she does not say, 'Forget not your whip.' She says, 'Forget not the whip.' It's a complete reversal of meanings, which is the theme of the work, isn't it?"
"The inversion of morals is the theme. Well, that and eternal recurrence."
"So shouldn't we examine each statement in it in light of that? A reversal of both morals and meanings? And secondly, of course, the whip is an expression of distance, of the patres de distanz, to which Nietzsche so often refers. With the whip, the woman requires that Zarathustra, the male prophet, maintain a wary distance."
"Superficially striking, but surely—"
"Bless you, Miss Lucy Gantz,"
Luce thought, recalling her philosophy teacher kindly as Von Bülow began his indignant refutation. 20 minutes later, they were crunching the last of the apples and going at it hammer and tongs about the meaning of over in relation to the concept of the Übermensch, and Luce was pointing out the fact that Über could as easily mean transcendent as superior, and that Mensch was used rather than man, conveying the more general sense of human being rather than specifically a male. Von Bülow wasn't a professional philosopher any more than Luce was. She gathered from some casual remarks that he was a scientist, probably a chemist, and they were contending on nearly equal ground. Horst was silent, except for a little helpless wheezing, and had a hand clamped firmly over his mouth. She thought she saw a tear trembling at the corner of one pale gray eye. Then his head came up, the amusement vanishing.
"Quiet!"
he barked in his officer's voice.
"Something's wrong."
Von Bülow did fall silent, for a wonder, with his index finger and mid-poke toward her in the air. Luce listened, too, and heard the scream of steel on steel, and felt the swift, hard lurch as the train's emergency brakes locked. She stuck her head out of the compartment window in time to see rooster tails of sparks from the six driving wheels going into full reverse as the engine turned into a curve before a small bridge. She didn't have time to check that the dark gap in the rails her first glance saw was really there. But the locomotive driver certainly thought so, and he had a much closer view. She'd just seen him and the fireman jump for it.
"Sabotage!"
she shouted, grabbing the leather straps above the seat and slamming her feet against the seat opposite her.
"The train's going to derail! Brace for it!"
The engine started to take the curve, and then there weren't any rails beneath the fore-truck, and then the driving wheels were biting uselessly into gravel and dirt. The 60-ton weight of the locomotive plowed down the embankment and into the water of the little river, and there was a deafening, roaring bang when the cold water struck the boiler and firebox, and the riveted seams yielded, then ripped open as the flaying steam within escaped in a huge whistle. Screams echoed in their wake as passengers were thrown across cabins, breaking bones and faces, and rivets and fragments flew like shrapnel. Luce gave a shivering grunt as the impact wrenched at her, but the springs she made of knees and thighs and back held, despite the savage wrench of the forces trying to turn her into a tumbling mass of organs wrapped around fragile ceramic sticks, and the strap that felt like it was cutting through her wrist. Horst managed too, and he had one iron arm braced across the professor's chest. The carriage they were in was the fourth back from the coal and water cars, and it came off the rails and almost immediately rammed into the one before, twisting until it lay three-quarters over, with the outer door of the compartment pointing down toward the damp ditch beside the track. The screams of humans seemed slight against the shriek of tortured metal.
"Out!" Horst snapped. "They'll be here any moment. This is an ambush."
He tried the door that led from the compartment to the outside, but the frame was jammed. Then he went down with his back on the canted floor, drawing his long legs up and slamming his boot heels downward and out into the door over and over again. The doors held for five impacts, hard enough to rock the carriage, and then screeched open with a sound of tearing metal.
"He really is Siegfried Fafnir's Bane come again," Luce thought. "Only not stupid, and not hip-deep in a sea of ants."
While Horst's boot heels hammered, Luce was moving quickly. She slung her suitcase over her back by its strap, opened the Frenchman's Gladstone bag, extracted the rifle, and fitted it together as Horst had demonstrated. It made a satisfying snick as the joints clicked together, and then she had 4 feet of automatic weapon, very much like the Colt Browning she'd used before. A moment, and she pulled the operating knob on the side to the rear and pushed 5 rounds from a stripper clip into the magazine with her thumb and let the bolt drive the first into the chamber. The rest of the ammunition went into the pockets of her skirt and 2 of the grenades into those of her jacket. By then, Horst was helping Von Bülow down the 5-foot gap to the torn, damp earth, making nothing of his weight.
"Come along, Herr Privatdozent," he said cheerfully. "The French are very determined to make your acquaintance, but this time I think they'll settle for killing you rather than kidnapping you for the Sorbonne."
"Putting my stuffed and mounted corpse on display at the Sorbonne, perhaps,"
Von Bülow surprised her by saying,
"like that lunatic Bentham at London University."
"Bright sun,"
Luce thought as she dropped through into a crouch with a rifle at port arms across her body and squinted around. It was bright for northern Europe, at least. You forgot how much farther north Europe was than the parts of America with similar climates. Without the Gulf Stream, this would be like Hudson Bay.
Just the time for the local climate not to be sodden and wet and misty and easy to hide in.
There was a dirt road to the west, then a wooden fence enclosing a broad field of something bushy. Potatoes. And then woods of oak and beech, with a few hints of color in the leaves, about 300 yards from the tracks. A flicker of movement between the car and the one to its rear, more nearly upright, showed a man in rough laborer's clothing climbing through with a shotgun in his hands, not more than 30 feet away. There wasn't time for anything but reaction. Lou swung the muzzle of the rifle around and squeezed off 3 shots from the hip, the hard bam, 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 cutting through the chorus of screams and moans of pain as it bucked in her hands. Shouts and the crackling crunch of metal contracting and buckling, and the growing crackle of fire from the coal truck and the crumpled lead wagon. The first round kicked up gravel from the track bed by the man's feet. The second sparked off the frame of the crumpled rail car behind him with a wicked ping, and the third took him in the shoulder. He fell backward with a scream. She thought she heard "Merde!" in it, and both barrels of the shotgun went off, with Buckshot whining uncomfortably close. A few people noticed, several of them idiotic enough to point and exclaim rather than hit the dirt, but several others were running, and they'd inform the authorities fairly soon. There was a village named Stockholm south of them, just in sight across flat, open country. Horst had slung the professor over his broad shoulder, but was hesitating. Luce tossed the carpet bag with the rest of the grenades and the shotgun and its ammunition to him, and snapped,
"Horst! I can't carry him!"
Or at least not at any speed, she didn't need to say. He nodded, the momentary irresolution leaving his face.
"To the woods! I'll cover you and then fall back!"
He sprinted to the fence, hit it running, and vaulted over, with one board creaking dangerously as the combined weight of the two men went on it. Then he was running across the field of potatoes, which was easier said than done. They were in hills parallel to his westward run, which meant there were little furrows and ridges just right to catch the foot, concealed by the knee-high plants. He bounded across the field at a dead sprint anyway, despite the carpet bag and 130-odd pounds of scientist, jinking irregularly from side to side as he went to keep from presenting a zero-deflection shot with what looked like an experienced infantryman's reflex.
"Horst said I was one of a kind. I certainly hope he is, or Germany really will rule the world."
Luce followed through the grass of the verge between the railroad right-of-way and the road, and then over more grass to the fence. With European tidiness and reluctance to waste an inch of ground, everything green had been grazed, probably by tethered sheep, which was good. The American equivalent would be a wild tangle of waist-high weeds, only hacked back a couple of times a year at best. Her skirts were cut with hidden pleats that allowed a full range of movement to her legs, but they were still more likely to catch on things than trousers. There were situations where a woman could wear trousers without attracting too much attention these days. On a wilderness hunting trip or in advanced circles when riding astride. But traveling on a respectable first-class train was not one of them. The only alternative was to dress and pass as a male, which she'd done when necessary. It was amazing what people didn't see. That would probably have stressed Horst too much, though. She reached the fence, which was board and post and about chest-high on her, hopped up and did a rollover using it as a fulcrum, and let herself drop to the ground, cushioning it a little by leading with the butt of the rifle.
"Oof,"
she said, as things in her pockets gouged her. The things included 2 grenades, and rough handling might dislodge a pin, but there was no point in thinking about that. There was a ridge of soil beneath the fence, thrown there over the years by plowing around the edge of the field, and it gave her a little cover. The dirt smelled damp, with the sharp, dusty smell of mature potato vines over it, and the scent of things burning that shouldn't from the train as wafts of smoke drifted by. The coal in the tender had all caught for starters, and that would burn hot enough to make metal slump. She squirmed around to lie facing the train, licked her thumb, and wet the foresight of the rifle, which had a simple adjustable leaf backside. She was about 150 feet away now, and with a fast-shooting round like the 7mm, that meant a flat trajectory, or near as no matter. Assuming the weapon was properly zeroed in with the sights in the lowest battle setting, which she just had to assume.
And die if it isn't. Here I am, risking my life to defend a mass murderer from justice at the hands of people who'll be American allies in a few weeks, she thought whimsically, and using their own rifle to do it.
Though the Deuxième Bureau hadn't hesitated to wreck a train full of neutral civilians. Still, compared to dropping poison gas on Paris, well, war was war. The train was still swarming with people, pulling the injured or trapped out of compartments, helping others away to lie still, or groaning on the ground, or standing and talking to each other. A few pointed to Horst running across the potato field with an elderly chemist slung over his shoulder.
"Ignore details. Look at everything. Purposeful movement will catch the eye, or weapons. There!"
A man's head and shoulders appeared over the edge of the roof of the rail carriage she'd been in. The way it was canted made it awkward for him, since he couldn't lie on the top without sliding down. He was probably being boosted from below, and he braced his elbows on the roof and leveled a rifle like the one she was carrying at Horst's fleeing figure. Still less than 200 yards away, easy for a good shot firing from a brace. She came up just enough to rest the forestock of the rifle on the lowest board of the fence, let the sight fall down on the triangle of head and shoulders, breathed out, held it, squeezed.
Crack, crack!
Two more brass shells spun off to her right, and the bolt locked back. The black silhouette, the man, jerked and toppled backward, probably with the ones below him trying to catch him. The rifle fell from his hands and slithered across the slanted top of the carriage and fell to the ground.
Crack!
And it fired as it landed, the bullet going who knew where. Hopefully not into someone's 6-year-old Annika, off to visit her grandma. But things were as they were. Luce was already on her feet, sprinting west and trading safety for speed by doing it in a straight line. She managed to reload as she went, shoving the charger clip in and pushing down to strip the rounds out and into the magazine. But the bolt nearly mashed her thumb as it ran forward, and the potato bushes caught at her skirts.
Monnier, you hijo de puta! Why didn't you use a detachable magazine like Browning when you designed this thing? Colt Brownings have 20 rounds, and you can just slap in a new one when you're in a hurry.
For 30 seconds there was only her own panting breath and footfalls, and the rustle and catch of vegetation against the hem of her skirt, and Horst dwindling in front of her. Was he powered by steam? Then a crack, crack from behind her, and a sound like ptow to her left, and a ripping echo following it like silk parting ptow again to her right. Those were rifle bullets going by, and far too close. She'd been bracketed, which meant the next one. Luce threw up her arms and collapsed forward, letting her body bounce flat with a rifle still loosely clasped in her left hand. And there was another ptow and the ripping sound right above her just as she fell.
No scream, no thrashing. Don't overdo.
More often than not, a couple of hits to the center of mass just made someone drop down limp as the body cavity flooded and blood pressure dropped. Hidden by the potato vines, her right hand went into her skirt pocket. The suit she was wearing today was a russet tweed for the jacket and skirt, and it should fade into the background of slightly wilted potato vines and brown dirt well, disguising details. She let her bobbed black hair flop over her face and controlled her breathing by an effort of main will, the urge to gasp in air almost overwhelming. But that would make her move, and with the loose sandy dirt of the field so close, it would mean breathing it in and then coughing, and the weedy scent of the crushed potato vines tickled her nose.
Madre de Dios, to die because I sneezed.
She lay and pushed it out of her mind, pushed out everything but sounds. The slow, thick wind of this country through the rustling vines, the distant noises of the wreck.
Marcel, we are getting in range of the woods. We should spread out. The rest will come in from the other side in a few minutes if we signal,
a sharp voice said, speaking with a nasal Picard accent, full of k sounds at the beginning of words, where most French speakers put sh.
Tiger Pierre, I want to make sure of the Boche bastard I shot, the one who killed Etienne, and get that other Monnier rifle back. These shotguns are useless in open country.
Cinco,
she thought.
Cuatro, tres, dos,
uno,
Lou spat aloud. She pulled the grenade out of her pocket, brought her left hand across, and jerked the pin free with her thumb through the ring, came up to her knee and threw, and let the motion spin her flat again, shoving her face down into the dirt between two rows of potatoes.
Pierre was right, she thought. They should have spread out. And Marcel is an idiot. He should have remembered we'd captured grenades with the rest of the snatch team's gear.
The three Frenchmen were standing about 10 feet from each other, the one in the center with a rifle like the one she carried, the other two with shotguns, all of them in coarse workman's clothes and flat cloth caps. The little clump was 100 feet from her, and she was fairly sure the grenade would land right where Pierre was standing with his rifle. Luce was good at throwing things. Her father had been a baseball enthusiast since he'd grown up in the game's New England home, and had played catch with her as a girl. And she'd trained with grenades specifically since joining the chamber, and since the Great War had shown they were necessary. A field operative wasn't an infantry soldier, but she needed some of the same skills sometimes, as in situations like this. The problem was that the Mills bomb was a defensive fragmentation grenade, meant to be thrown from places where you could duck down behind cover after you sent it toward the enemy. Jagged shards of the cast-iron shell would almost certainly hit anyone standing within 50 feet of the point of impact, and could go as far as 200. Those miserable 6-inch ridges of loose earth were a very poor substitute for a sandbagged trench, and she very much did not want a piece of cast iron pinwheeling into her skull. Someone started to shout, "Grenade!" in French, getting as far as, "Grenade!" There was a loud but unspectacular flat "boomf" sound, followed by a pattering as dirt fell back to earth. In the same instant, a man began to scream, a high wailing sound that didn't end. Luce winced inwardly a little as she snatched up the rifle and dashed across the field. A single backward glance had told her she didn't need to worry about those three Frenchmen again, though some of them might live.
"This is beginning to get ridiculous," she thought. "I'm decimating the Duchenne Bureau's operations in the Netherlands. And if I don't get the information out of Germany, whatever it is, I'm helping whatever German plan this is succeed."
Intelligence work was full of paradoxes, and could astonish you with flights of what was supposed to be logic and wheels within wheels. But this... She didn't stop when she came to the edge of the woods. They were open in the European style, tended like a garden, with none of the litter of deadfalls and outer screen of saplings and underbrush she was used to in the American equivalents. Instead, she ran another 20 yards and plastered herself to the other side of a beech tree 4 feet thick. Luce was just trying to work up enough spit to whistle when Horst's voice called from above her.
"Very well done. You are welcome on any trench raid I lead. That was extremely impressive, Manasusa."
So was the speed you ran at, sweetie, Luce replied.
Luce felt a rush of relief mixed